We're your hosts, Ross Arntzen and Rob Hanley. I've often wondered why some people have a different idea of how they feel about themselves. Where does it all start, and how can we change it within ourselves? So we decided to go to the expert on the subject, Dr. Joe Rubino, founder of the Center for Personal Reinvention. And he just happens to have a new book on the subject, The Ultimate Guide to Boost the Most Underrated Ingredient for Success and Happiness in Life. Joe, how have you been?
Ross, I've been just great. So thanks so much for having me today.
Oh, we're always, it's a pleasure to
have
you
on the show
today.
Joe.
Just
thank you,
fantastic.
Rob.
And so let's get into this, because this is my favorite subject. It really is. I love to speak about this as often as I possibly can. In layman's terms, though, let's get some basics down here. What do you do at the Center for Personal Reinvention?
Well, Ross, basically we champion people's lives. We not only look to increase people's productivity and help them to win in life, to be successful in whatever endeavors they're out to achieve, but also we look to get to the source of their happiness. We look to champion not only their values to support them to be most fulfilled, but we enhance communication among people. We support people to build teams. We actually have people step into their magnificence and be great. That's really what the Center for Personal Reinvention is all about. It's
about that. Step into their magnificence.
Yeah, it's really about people being the best that they can be, just kind of like the Marines.
Just like the Marines. Do you think that it's kind of a realization that people have, that people are already great or they're becoming great? Is it kind of a statue in the stone? They don't realize how truly magnificent they are? Or is it more something that everybody is kind of a piece of clay, maybe, that needs to be molded into something magnificent?
Well, I really believe that we're all born magnificent and that somewhere along the line we lose sight of it. And so the work that we do is to really have people get in touch with that magnificence and to return themselves to unraveling all of the layers so that they can get back to who they really are. Because beyond the core of all of the garbage that we put on top of our magnificent core, we have that essence inside of us. And it's really just a matter of getting back down to realizing who we are as spiritual beings, really, that are just fantastic and have so much to contribute to others and to the world.
Very good. As a parent of two toddlers, a soon-to-be 4-year-old and a soon-to-be 2-year-old, I'm always very interested, and my main thing is to build self-confidence. I'm so thrilled that we're talking about this subject here as well. So assuming everybody is born, and that's my belief also, everybody is born magnificent, what happens? So my kids are born with wonderful self-confidence. Do they, somewhere along the way, how do they think that they're not then? That's kind of my belief. I'd like to talk about that.
We all start out that way. We all start out thinking that we're invincible. You know, you ask a little kid, what do you want to be? And probably the most common answer is an astronaut or the president of the United States or something phenomenal. So we all start out with that core essence that we can do anything. And then at some point, something happens that has us change our belief in our ability to be and do and have anything that we want. You mentioned with your 2-year-old and your 4-year-old, it really helps to have great parents like you and your wife to champion these kids early on, to have them have a sense that they are wonderful, that they are loved, and that they can do whatever they want to do. And in spite of the great work that you'll be doing with them, everyone does make something up at some point, or we buy into things that someone says that has us feel somewhat less than, somewhat unlovable, somewhat not worthy. And, of course, there's a very wide range where some kids really decide early on that they're not lovable, that they're not good enough, and that there's something definitely wrong with them. And then they take that thought and they see the world through those glasses, and then they reinterpret the next event that will happen in such a way that it just confirms the fact of what they suspected all along, which was that there was something wrong with them. So with your little kids, all you can do is you continually love them and you can continually reinforce that they are valuable, that they are worthy, that they are magnificent in all ways, and that, you know, we all make mistakes from time to time. And the important thing is not to beat yourself up over something that happens, but to learn from it and to grow and to move forward.
Wow. Okay, so Joe, now I'm an adult and I still don't feel loved and I'm overweight. And I'm angry all the time, and I have no friends, I have a bad attitude, but I still want to be successful. What's going to happen when I meet you and I go to the center?
Well, it really is about you, Ross, and it has to do with how motivated are you to reinvent yourself? How motivated are you to get in touch with the source of your anger and the things that you made up about yourself that has you be overweight, that has you, you know, chronically eat, or has you be angry and have relationships that aren't working with people? So what we really do is we get in touch with the things that you made up about not only yourself, but about your relationships with other people. Who are other people to you? And when you can start to reinterpret and reframe your world, reframe how you see others and how you see yourself, now you have a chance to get really back to the core of the thought process that you've created, and you can actually flip that thought process like a light switch, and we'll talk a little bit about that later in the show today.
Wow. Okay, so I have to ask you, is this the kind of program where I wake up in the morning and I go find a mirror and I say, I'm happy, I'm happy, I'm happy, I'm happy?
Well, you know, I think what you're talking about is affirmations. Mm-hmm. And affirmations are great. I think everyone should affirm who they are. And they're not enough. It's kind of like putting a Band-Aid over a festering wound. The wound is not going to heal if it's infected and if it's really in tough shape. And it's the same with our core being. If we don't get to the source of the decisions that we made about ourselves and others, then we're really just trying to cover it up with positive thinking, which is a good step, but it's not nearly enough. We really need to get to the source. We need to complete the troubled past. And what I mean by that is to identify where we made up some things that don't support our thinking. And then once we can reinterpret that past and we can forgive ourselves and forgive others if that's necessary, we can then take an inventory of where we are now in our present state and look at where do we want to go, where are we now, what do we need to put into place, what's missing, and then we can invent the future on purpose by creating a vision for our lives and then an action plan that's in sync with that vision so that we can actually move forward and be powerful.
You know, when you talked about not getting to the core there, you said getting to the core, it reminded me of something I've heard somebody say one time. They said, in doing some of these cosmetic, these Band-Aid type of things, he said, what this is likened to is having a baby with a dirty diaper and putting a brand new fresh diaper over the top of the dirty one.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Doesn't really do a whole lot. You got to get to the core source. So.
Yeah, absolutely. We got to get rid of that diaper and clean up the baby.
So you're saying that really someone's self-esteem is programmed into them as they were younger, as they're maturing and growing, and also that it's a choice. This sounds like a very complex program that you have put together, which is my next question is obvious. Why did you write this book, the self-esteem book?
Well, Ross, it's estimated that at least 85 and possibly higher percentage of people in the world suffer from low self-esteem. And low self-esteem is really the source of all of the suffering and the pain in the world. It's the cause of broken relationships. It's the source of poor communication between people. It's the cause of people not living up to their potential and realizing their gifts and manifesting them in the world. It's actually the source of wars and divorces and all of the bad things that you can possibly imagine. So that if we can actually get to the bottom of why we feel poorly about ourselves, we can start now to clean that up so that we can live deliberately, we can design our futures on purpose, we can honor our values, and the bottom line is we can be happy and successful and be really that magnificent person that we know that we really are.
Is that essentially the message of this book then, Joe? I mean, what is the predominant this being such a huge challenge, we're talking about 85 to 90% of the people suffering from, you know, not really knowing their greatness. What's the predominant message then overall in the book? How do we address this?
Well, Robert, it's really about the fact that no one needs to settle for a dimmed existence, for the feelings that they're not worthy, for unhappiness and resignation. It's really about...
Is that what they do also? Do they just settle, they give up and figure that's how it's going to be too?
Well, that's what happens as a matter of course over time when you first realize that there's something wrong with you, or at least you make that up, or you buy into someone else telling you that. And then you start to look at the world in ways where people say something and you realize now that you're not good enough, and so you respond and react to them in such a way that reinforces that for you. And so after you do this day in and day out for 10 and 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 years of your life, pretty soon it becomes invisible. Pretty soon you have it as a fact that you are not worthy, that you are not good enough. And so why even bother, you know, because that resignation kills our soul. It's kind of like the cancer of the soul where we give up on ourselves and we start now to interact with people like there is something wrong with us. And that translates into us being angry or sad or afraid. It translates into us not having friends and not wanting to risk in social situations. It has us play small so that we don't live our dreams in the business world. We just settle for being the person that just takes the scraps because we don't think that we deserve, you know, the prime cut.
Was it Thoreau, I think? I'm trying to think who said this, but it's the people that give up on their dreams and they live lives of quiet desperation.
Exactly. I couldn't have said it better. That quiet desperation is the insidious, the cancer that just kills people's spirit and has them stay small and stuck. And the great news is that it's totally unnecessary.
Joe, you know, you've said, you know, people, they buy into this and they allow this and programmed with this. What is typically the source of low self-esteem? Where does it all begin?
Well, it begins when we're a little child, usually before the age of 5, and someone does something or says something, and we interpret what they do or what they say as meaning that there's something wrong with us. And sometimes someone actually says, you know, you're a bad boy, or, you know, you're a bad girl and you've done something wrong, or, you know, you're ugly, or, you know, you smell funny or whatever. And that's the first moment that we start to realize that, well, here we are going along pretty happy as a kid, and some deciding moment happens when we first start to suspect that there's something wrong with us, that we're different, that we don't measure up, that we're not like the other kids, or we're unlovable. You know, maybe our parents are divorced. So it can be something significant that happens. It also can be something relatively minor that we as adults would look back on and say, how could this little child make something like that up? For me, when I was a little kid, I was maybe 4 years old, and I wanted this robot commando, I remember, for Christmas. And
I wanted one of those.
You had one of those? Oh, they were great, weren't they?
With the kung fu grip.
That's right. Well, what I got instead was a sweater and an alarm clock. And what I made up about myself at that time was that I must not be good enough to merit the robot commando. And so I started to look at other situations in life from the perspective of, you know, if I was good enough, then parents would have bought me what I wanted. They wouldn't have given me a sweater and an alarm clock. You know, who wants these things? And so it can be something that minor where, you know, my parents were not very wealthy. They were doing the best they could. And the bottom line was they were very practical. And, you know, this robot probably cost $100 or so, which was a lot of money back then. And the bottom line is that anything can happen where a little child makes something up. It could be that, you know, little Susie has a new brother come into the world when she's 3. And she makes up that if she was good enough, her parents wouldn't need to have another brother for her. Instead of that, you know, they love her so much that they wanted her to have a playmate. So it's all about some disempowering interpretation that really has people feel as though there's something wrong with them, that they messed up somehow, and that now they're going to have to go through the rest of their life feeling and living a cover-up, a lie, putting on a facade so that the whole world doesn't find out that there's something wrong with them.
So that interpretation is possibly the reason why you have one child who is very, very successful, and you have another child who is homeless or a criminal. Both raised exactly the same way, but those children are interpreting their environment and the things that are said to them, et cetera, all differently. And so it's affecting their self-esteem differently as they grow up. Is that pretty close to what you're saying?
It's exactly right. Something happens, and before you know it, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where little Jane sees herself as ugly and so someone says something that has nothing to do with Jane, but someone says something to Jane's friend, and Jane says, well, that person might have paid more attention to me or said something to me if I wasn't ugly. And so now Jane hides out, and instead of going to the party, Jane makes off that she's sick and she stays home. Right. And so now Jane says, the next time she doesn't get invited to the party because she wasn't at the last one. And so Jane says, well, if there wasn't something wrong with me, I would have been invited to the party. Nobody likes me. I'm ugly. You know, there's something wrong with me. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So now the next time Jane gets angry at the person and creates a fight because she's hurt that she wasn't invited to the party. And so now the other person who was her friend says, well, you know, I don't want to be friends with you anymore because you've got problems. And one thing leads to another. And by the time Jane is 30 and 40 and 50 years old, she's created this reality around herself in her world where she's actually manifested her greatest fear. And really, that is what our lives become. They become manifestations of however we think, whether that's excellence or doom.
Well, so, Joe, I think you've made half the parents out there listening paranoid as far as what to say to their kids.
I'll tell you quickly what the kind of thing I say to my kids, and is this being such a central part of my life, is I program them. My four-year-old now, when I put him down for bed right before he's going to sleep, I'll ask him, who's a great boy? And he says, I'm a great boy. Who's a happy boy? I'm a happy boy. And we go through 10 iterations, who's strong, who's smart, who's this, who's happy, who's, you know, a leader. We go through 10, and every, you know, he may not understand everything, but you know what? He's actually, even at less than 4 years old, he's doing affirmations. And my just almost a two-year-old, her sweet little girl, who's precious? I'm precious. Who's a princess? I'm a princess. And so from everything that we're coming at, Joe, is that obviously we're very much on the same page that this is all about programming. So somebody has got a downward spiral here. Let's just say they weren't raised by, you know, parents maybe like I am and try to be the greatest parent I can. But in contrast to all this feeling of unworthiness, what happens is you talk about upset-free life in reversing a downward spiral that somebody that's gone 40 years, as you mentioned a second ago, how do they do this? How do they get out of this?
Before I address that one, Rob, first I want to say that kids that are as fortunate to have parents like you, you're nurturing, you're empowering, you're championing them to be the best that they can be. And for parents out there that might not have had those sorts of awarenesses early on, I'm going to invite them not to beat themselves up about it, because even parents that do a great job in trying to have their kids grow up with high self-esteem, oftentimes the kid makes up something about himself or herself that actually has nothing to do with reality, then goes off and, unknown to the parents, this vicious cycle continues because of actions and thought that the child continues to adopt, whereas the parent has no knowledge of this and really is doing the best that he or she knows how to do. Now, with respect to the downward spiral of diminishing self-esteem and the destructive anger that comes with it and all of that, there is a way for us to actually achieve that goal of an upset-free life, and that's by reframing what people do and say. It's about creating new interpretations that are empowering, that support happiness and rich relationships, instead of interpretations that have us feel poorly about who we are. And so what it comes down to is the work that we do in our courses and through personal coaching is all about separating out the facts of what someone says or does from the interpretations or the meaning that we give those facts.
Can I jump in real quick? Because I'm getting like a big revelation here, and I love to connect the dots. So in interpreting, that means I can choose whatever it is that I interpret. And one thing that I heard one time someone say here, if I can remember here, was something that self-realization or self-esteem is not what you think of yourself and not what other people obviously think of you, but it's what you think other people think of you. Am I on the right track here that you can actually make up stories that, gosh, this guy thinks that I'm cool or this guy thinks that I've got it going on? Is that right?
That is right, Rob, and it even goes farther than that. When we can put ourselves in the other person's world, and let's say that someone is mean to you, and, you know, like the bully syndrome.
Okay.
So how can a little child who's being beat up in the playground come up with an empowering interpretations and when, you know, maybe there's several people picking on her or him. And so what that child can do is to say, you know, what is it like? And this is how the parents can support the interpretation process. What is it like for Barry's world that he would be a bully? You know, do you think that he's happy? Do you think that he feels loved? Do you think that he feels secure? Or do you think that he's angry and that he's looking to express his anger in a way that has nothing to do with you? So that when we can support kids to see that the interpretations that they created that there's something wrong with me isn't accurate at all. It's, well, maybe the other person is living out something that they feel there's something wrong with them, and you just happen to be the poor kid minding
wow.
his own business in the schoolyard that, you know, gets beat up.
So instead of them thinking about the fact that they're weak or they're inadequate or they're deserving of some kind of, you know, condemnation, in that story almost that you're planting in your child's mind, you're actually turning the tables almost and giving them the power or empowering them almost to pity or to have empathy for those that would be persecuting them. That's amazing.
Well, you know, that's really what distinguishes people who are effective in life from people who feel as though life is giving them a bad rap and a bad deal. It's about looking at people as doing the best they know how to do. Now, we're not saying that we're going to condone actions like that, like bullying or, you know, being mean to people. But if we can separate out the fact that they're not doing it to us, they're just doing it. And they're doing it because of who they are, not because of who we are. We can now separate out the actions from the recipient of the actions so that we can see that there's nothing wrong with us. And what they're doing is about them. And so we can feel good about ourselves and actually have that empathy for the other person that maybe there's something wrong with them. And that doesn't mean that we put ourselves in harm's way or anything like that. But
let's
just a place to come from.
Let's talk about actions and then feelings. Because, you know, I don't always feel like doing stuff. And I think that, you know, you have to learn to kind of say, oh, you know, my emotions don't control me. And people have moods. So the moods are going to dictate a lot of times what your actions are going to be, or at least for the average person that's out there. I'm sure that's not the case with you. But maybe let's talk about moods here, because we're all talking about perception and glass half empty, glass half full. So, I mean, what are the dominant moods people have, and how do they shape things? I mean, what's so important about how feelings play into this whole thing, how moods play into this whole thing?
Well, moods are the core that makes this whole dynamic go round, Rob. And we all have a mood that's a predominant mood, and it's typically one of three different feelings or moods. And anger is the most predominant one. Most people have that mood that they go to first. And for many people, it very quickly goes into fear or sadness. And so what will happen is someone will say something or someone will do something, and the mood will kick in. For example, my mood is indignant anger. Whenever someone does something, the first thought that comes to mind, if I'm not paying attention to this automatic mood, is how dare you? You know, I could be having dinner at a restaurant and I'll smell some cigar smoke from the next room, and thing that I will feel is, you know, how dare you smoke cigars here in this restaurant? Don't you know that people hate cigar smoke and it's bad for you and all of this? And what I'll need to do is to reframe that and say, well, here's a poor guy just enjoying a cigar, and that, you know, a lot of people love cigars, and
yeah,
you know, he's just having a good time for himself over there, and it has nothing to do with me, and it has nothing to do with the fact that he wants to hurt someone else. So the moods of either anger, sadness, or fear actually come about because of the interpretation that we put on the action or the words that we hear from someone. So when those moods kick in, we can either lavish in the mood, so we can be terribly angry, we can be raging, we could be fearful, we could have whatever someone says really scare the heck out of us, or it could send us into a real sad mode where we feel sorry for ourselves and we just feel gloom and doom all the time. Or we can reframe what is said or what is done in such a way that we create an empowering interpretation that takes the sting out of it being about us. Instead of making up that it's about us, we can make up something totally different. And, you know, I'm happy to give you an example of that if you'd like.
Sure.
Let's just take one of the more prominent moods of anger. And we're getting back to the situation in the schoolyard where someone's being bullied. Rather than the person who's being bullied, let's call that person Tom. thinking there's something wrong with me, that's why I'm getting beat up. Trump can instead reframe the situation, like I was saying, and say, well, what's wrong with this person that he has so much anger that he's taking it out on me? So the reframing, the reinterpretation of that is there's nothing wrong with me. There's something that the other person's angry about. And then we as adults, we can even take that one step further and we could say, who am I being? What did I say or do that has this person responding in this sort of manner to me? So that we can actually take proactive responsibility and maybe shifting how we're coming across to others so that we're not eliciting the kind of response that we don't want.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, so Joe, we fall into these moods, and we all do. And we know that everyone has moods, and it's part of being a human being. It's what separates us from all the other species. So we say we hate these moods. So why do we stay in them for so long? I guess the next question after that would be, how do we get out?
Well, the moods are very addicting.
You're so caught up.
Yeah, they make us right. They are like a heroin addict getting a heroin fix. Mm. They're that addicting. When we're in our mood of anger, fear, or sadness, we feel as though we can dominate others with that, whether that's being angry at someone and so shutting them down because it gives us this false sense of power so that we can avoid being dominated. Or maybe we're sad and we feel sorry for ourselves and we get other people to feel sorry for us and we dominate them that way by being a victim. It's also maybe a way that we can excuse or justify our behavior so that we can avoid responsibility for our actions. Our moods are so powerful that even though we say we don't like them, we end up trading our happiness, our peace of mind, our relationships with others just to be right and to stay in those moods of anger, sadness, or fear. And so the option that we all have that we don't always know is that we always can choose to shift out of those moods instantaneously, like hitting that light switch that I mentioned a little while ago, just by creating a new interpretation that is mood-free.
So is that the key to doing this? I mean, is that what we're talking about? Obviously, you wouldn't want to be angry or sad or scared. I mean, I think it's safe to say, I think, although maybe I'm wrong, maybe it is that you're addicted to being angry, but surely people, if they consciously would choose, they choose to be happy and satisfied. Is that the key then? I mean, what is the key to not being angry or sad or scared? Is this exactly what we're talking about?
Rob, I think you already hit it, though. I think you just said it's consciously. Isn't that what you're talking about, Joe? It's the difference between what you consciously want and what you subconsciously do?
Yes, it's about recognizing when you're in the mood first, because if you don't recognize that you're angry or that you're sad or that you're afraid, you have no ability to alter that mood. So key number one is to see the mood as a red flag that's a gift to you. And when you notice first that you're in your mood, you can then look at asking yourself, what did someone say or do that had me feel angry, sad, or afraid? When you recognize, Sally said you're a mean person, then what you can do is you can make up an interpretation that's different from the one that caused your mood that has you be mood free. So, Sally said you're a mean person. So the interpretation might be that Sally's a very sensitive person and that you said something that triggered something in her. So you can create a new interpretation that has you be powerful, that has you be unaffected by the words or the actions of others so that you can stay in a positive mood and a positive mode, and you can actually recognize your faulty thinking just when the mood starts to surface, and you can shift out of it proactively so that it never kicks in and it never causes the reaction which causes the damage, which just cements home the whole destructive behavior.
It's kind of like polishing down a lens or a prescription to your glasses, almost, if you will, that you see the world through. And what I'm thinking is that when Sally says something or does something that hurts your feelings, instead of you thinking, I'm undeserving or I'm this or I'm that or I'm the other, you automatically, thinking that maybe the prescription almost that you have when you're living a happy, self-fulfilled life is that you're happy and self-fulfilled. So you think, Sally must have a problem. And is that kind of how this is eventually, that it just comes up and you're thinking to yourself, maybe Sally's having a bad day, and it's not an introspective thing, but you're thinking, is that kind of how this can develop into?
Yeah, we can actually create whatever interpretation we want to that empowers us to move the whole situation forward and feel good about who we are and maintain the relationship, because a lot of this is about the relationship. And when someone says or does something, we have a choice. We can either react angrily or sad or become fearful, or we can respond in a way that supports our relationships and our happiness and our health and all of that. And so there's two aspects to it. One is to say, well, there must be something going on with Sally over there to have her say or do something like that. And the other, as I mentioned before, is to actually take responsibility for looking first at, you know, what could I have done differently that would have not elicited such a reaction, so that it's being in development around how to be effective with people. And it doesn't mean that you did something wrong, but if the same sort of stuff is happening around you all of the time, like people are always reacting angrily toward you, and you're the common denominator here in time after time after time of people reacting in ways like this, well, then it's time to look at, well, who am I being, or how is my thought process such that I'm bringing this into my life? Because, you know, ultimately, we take the interpretation that we're responsible for everything that shows up in our lives. Not like it's true, like we walk across the street, we get hit by the bus that just came out of nowhere. But what if we say that we are absolutely responsible for everything that manifests in our life? It gives us a starting place to come from so that we can start to look at what could I have shifted so that this won't continue to manifest in my world. And that's a real powerful place to come from.
If your mind is a garden, right, and we're saying weeds automatically are going to pop up in your garden here, and these negative, these moods. So what are the costs if you don't? You're not tending your garden. What are the costs of these moods? I mean, what happens? You talk a lot about this.
Yeah, they're tremendous. They range anything from health. You know, if we're always angry, our health suffers. We have headaches. We have TMJ problems. We'll have heart disease, cancer, not only health but happiness. The moods just kill our happiness. We're always in conflict, so it's hard to be happy when you're always in turmoil. Relationships are huge. If we don't have fulfilling, supportive relationships, it's because we're probably reacting all the time and we're angry a lot of the time, or we're sad or we're afraid. Intimacy suffers. So there's a lot of different areas that if our self-image is low, we actually cause the areas to suffer. Our moods are present, and before we know it, our life suffers. Everything from our health and our relationships and our happiness to the potential that we have to impact others and be wealthy and abundant and successful and happy.
Very good.
You just don't realize how powerful this is and how it affects your life and what you may have given up or pushed away in the past until you really sit down and think about this and look at how you've reacted to, you know, situations in your life. You talk about all the areas of personal development in the self-esteem book. Why is putting yourself in the other person's world such an important area of development to take on?
Well, if you're unwilling or unable to have empathy for other people, there's no possibility of reinterpretation. You'll always see everything that someone says or does as an insult or an affront or a way that they are competing for the great things in the world with you, as opposed to doing the best that they know how to do. And out of doing the best they know how to do, they're going to mess up sometimes because of how they see the world, just as you and I are going to mess up. So the empathy that we create actually supports that feeling of mutuality, where we look at people as in this with us as opposed to in this against us. And so if we want peace and we want love and we want nurturing relationships that work in our lives, then we have to have the ability to put ourselves in the other person's world to be able to create a new interpretation that has us stay in relationships with the people.
And so with the Center for Personal Reinvention, what is personal reinvention and how does that work with the self-esteem book? How are the two tied together?
Well, the great thing about all of this, Ross, is that we get to declare who we are as a possibility for our futures. And so personal reinvention is really about declaring who you are, as opposed to looking at all the evidence that we all create that says we're anything other than magnificent and wonderfully, you know, supportive and empowering beings. And so what personal reinvention is all about is getting clarity about the person that you decide to be, and then from that moment forward, doing those things which will support that declaration. So it's about deciding, for example, if let's say that you are the person that you asked me about early in the show, where you said, you know, you're overweight, you're angry, you have no friends,
right,
and now you want to reinvent yourself. Well, the first thing that I would ask myself is, if I was not angry, well, first, what am I angry about? And we'd get to the source of the anger. We'd get to the interpretations that you made up that don't support you, and we'd be show you the ability to shift out of that anger in the moment. Now, the interpretation that you have no friends. Well, you have no friends probably because you're angry all the time and because you're damaging your relationships. So what if we go back and we now declare ourselves as a friend, as a great supportive friend, someone who is able to thrive in mutually supportive relationships that work. So now I'm going to meet this next person, and I'm going to come from a place of being a great friend. What would a great friend do or say if I were a great friend? And so when you come from the declaration of who you are as opposed to who you are afraid that you have been, your actions are going to be totally different. You're going to reinvent yourself moment by moment. Because the great thing about the world is it gives us an unending series of opportunities to reinvent ourselves daily and really moment by moment.
Wow. So, I mean, so what you're really saying is that, you know, no matter where you're at in your life, it's not too late to reinvent yourself.
It isn't. And, you know, once we get in touch with what our most important values are, and we're either honoring those values or we're not. And if we want to reinvent ourselves, the first thing is to get clarity about what it will take to have your values be honored, so that if you have a value of love and you're angry all the time, you're dishonoring that value. If you have a value of abundance and you're not knowing where your next meal is going to come from, you're dishonoring that value. We also have many gifts that lay dormant and that we're not manifesting in our relationships and in the world. And so we're not being productive, we're not being abundant because they're being suppressed. So it's all about identifying who we really are and declaring that to the world and then living out of that declaration day by day.
So, Joe, can you give us an example or two about what personal development program might look like for somebody that is actually looking? They've come to the realization, I'm not the person that I want to be. I want to be happier and more fulfilled. I don't want to live this life, and I want to think differently. They've realized they want to reinvent themselves. How does that look? How does that shape up?
Well, Rob, the first thing that we would do is we'd take a detailed analysis of what's working in their lives and what's missing from the point of view that if they were honoring their values, if their life was ideally lived, what would shift? And that translates into a vision, really, that we help them to create with respect to how would each aspect of their life look if they were waving a magic wand over their lives and they had the ability to live a vision in all aspects of life, with their health, with their finances and wealth, with their relationships, with their recreation and fun, with their job or their avocation in life. All of the things that really matter, how would each of those look so that if you could design your life on purpose, you get to determine what it's going to look like. So we encourage people to write that vision out in first-person present tense as though it is already happening and it is a reality, and then to read that vision a couple of times a day, in the morning typically when you wake up and at night before you go to bed. And that vision will be a huge affirmation of who the person now claims and declares themselves to be. And it's in line with their life purpose. It's in line with their values. And it's in line with the principles that make life worth living. And when people can gain clarity about who is that person that they decide and choose to be from this point onward, and they start designing their lives on purpose, now they're in essence reinventing themselves moment by moment.
Very good.
Joe, the self-esteem book is an absolute masterpiece. It's a work of art. It really is. And in this book, you talk about belief and expectation and self-motivation. Can you speak as to why belief is so important to one's self-esteem and to their success, and how the two are tied?
Ross, without belief, we will end up sabotaging ourselves, and here's the reason. We create our futures in line with what we expect. And so if we believe that we're going to be successful and happy and at peace, we will be self-motivated to do things and to be with people in such a way that that is our manifestation. If we believe that there's going to be scarcity in the world and that there's going to be anger and that people are hateful and that it's a dog-eat-dog world, then our expectation is that we're going to be in survival mode and we will manifest that same reality. And if we look to the future and we think that it's no use, things are always going to be pretty much like they are, give or take a little bit, we'll have this resignation that has us kill the life force inside of us so that we will actually manifest through the apathy, a similar situation to what we have now. So the bottom line is that however we believe the future will be, we will create the self-motivation to actually bring it about on purpose. So the good news there is that if we can train ourselves to expect and really demand a future that's compelling and inspirational and rewarding in all ways, loving and nurturing and abundant, now we have the ability to design that future on purpose and make it a self-fulfilling prophecy by expecting it to happen.
Is this, Joe, is this what we're talking about when we're talking about vision, when we're talking about these areas? I mean, when we're you say creating a vision for yourself and your future and doing this on purpose, vision is more strong. It's not just this would be nice or that would be nice. I mean, what is vision and specifically what areas should be included in visions? I mean, is it just money or what is it?
No, it's really all areas of our lives. And it really, I want to clarify something, and that's we already have a vision.
Okay.
It's not that we're lacking vision. It's just that when we look around ourselves at what's manifesting in our world, if we don't like what's showing up, that's our vision. So we actually have the ability to recreate a new, empowering, awesome vision that will replace the current vision, just like if I had a glass of coffee here in before me and I took a picture of water where the water represents the new vision and the coffee represents the old murky resigned vision. If I pour enough of the new clear water into the coffee cup, pretty soon what's going to happen is the old murky vision is going to be replaced by the new empowering vision. And it's the same way in our lives. When we can look in the areas of what will we have, which is a manifestation of what we will do and who we are being. So the most important element there being, the qualities that we're known for, how we see the world and how other people see us. And then when we're being these qualities, we're going to be doing those things that that kind of person does. So, for example, if I'm being inspirational and charismatic and loving, I'm going to be doing those sorts of things. I'm going to be interacting with people in a loving way, in a way that champions them and supports them and inspires them and challenges them, and they get a good feeling from my energy. And then, of course, I'll have those things that I want when I'm being and doing the things that are in alignment with that vision. And, of course, any vision that is only about ourselves lacks contribution and isn't inspiring to others. So any compelling, empowering, positive vision will always have an element of contribution where it's not just about us, it's about others.
Hmm. Well, Joe, one of the topics you talk about in the book is about listening, which is my absolute favorite topic. But you've taken this way beyond my sense or my idea of listening, and you use two terms that really, really just resonated with me: automatic listening and generating a listening. Tell us about those, because it's phenomenal.
Well, we all already listen in a certain way, and that's
right.
An automatic listening. So like I mentioned with myself, my mood of indignant anger, how dare you. That
mm-hmm.
is an example of a way that I automatically listen to the world. And so the way that I can generate a new listening is an empathetic listening, a listening for mutuality, a listening to support harmony in life. And so when someone does something, you know, they cut me off in traffic, I instead of going to that anger and how dare you, I create a new interpretation. You know, this person perhaps just had an emergency at home where their child is in danger and they're in a hurry to get there. Not like it's true, because, you know, I don't know that it's true, but I also don't know that the reason why I think they cut me off, which is because they're a jerk, is true either. So the new interpretation that I'm creating is mood-free. It has absolutely no power to it, and it supports my relationship, and it makes me happier to take it on. So I start to listen in a generated way, to a way where I take on the qualities that I've declared myself to be. And when I can listen from being an inspiration, listen from being supportive, listen from being loving and championing, all of those qualities, life shows up in a wholly different way than when I listen automatically, which is, you know, how dare you and what's in it for me.
Wow. That's incredible. That really is. And you say that people operate out of good intentions, and that it is important to forgive people for what they do, you know, as they hurt you, which is, you know, the basis of, you know, many, many people's belief. What do you mean by this, though, and why is forgiveness so important?
Well, without forgiveness, we are so stuck in the past that we can't move forward. And whenever we're incomplete with something, we cannot reinvent. We cannot move forward in a powerful way because our energy is constantly in the past. So the whole notion that people do the best that they know how to do is something that we make up about every person in the world because, you know what, we have no clue what exactly it's like to live anyone else's life except for our own. We know that we've made things up about ourselves and about others based upon our experiences. And so what we do is we assume that other people, you know, do the same thing and make the same mistakes. And so when we can give people the benefit of the doubt that even though we don't condone their actions, that they're doing the best that they know how to do based upon how they see the world. And, you know, some people see the world as very competitive, very hostile, very much a world where if you don't get others, they're going to get you. And so when we see that we can put ourselves in people's shoes that way, we now have the ability to create some empathy for them. And it doesn't mean that we have to be a victim. We have to be putting ourselves, you know, in front of the train all of the time and get run over by these angry, vicious people. But what it means is that we can no longer be at the effect of what someone says or does.
Wow.
And when we can do that, it just frees us up. And not only does it increase our self-esteem, but it allows us to be happier and have more fulfilling relationships.
You know, I love the whole thing around forgiveness, Joe. And I think that's almost something that's a topic, obviously, we could talk for an entire hour just on that.
It's very, very powerful.
And it's truly a biblical principle. I mean, I've read that, you know, you can expect nothing if you hold something against somebody else. And here's the thing that I really like about it is most people feel like I can't forgive this person because they don't deserve it. They haven't earned it. They haven't asked for it. And you know, some things like that there's some things that they have to do in order to receive your forgiveness. And it actually, because they don't deserve it. But the thing about this, and I'm hearing you say right now, it's really coming up strongly for me, is forgiveness is actually very empowering. Because the forgiveness, and what I've recently been taught, is forgiveness is actually about how that's going to impact you. And it's not about how they deserve it or how they do whatever. It's a choice overall that you're making. And if you think about it being a choice, golly, that's really empowering overall just on its own. So I love that whole discussion around forgiveness. Is that kind of what you were saying there?
Well, that's so right on, Robin. You know, I like to think of forgiveness as the words forgiving. Like, thank you for giving me an opportunity to grow and to experience something that makes me a better person, a person who's more wise and able to impact more people.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the whole notion of forgiving, you're not only forgiving people because you're putting yourself in their shoes and seeing that they've done the best that they know how to do in spite of their shortcomings. But we're forgiving people also for ourselves, because anytime we refuse to forgive people, we stay stuck in that whole episode and our energy gets drained.
You can't release it.
We stay in the past and we stay, you know, and then all the costs come up of being, you know, in poor health, in misery, and with broken relationships and all of that. So forgiveness just forms just a great way to move things forward in a way where we've learned a lesson and we know that there's some things that we're going to do differently in the future and some things that other people are going to do differently. And, you know, that's what life's really all about. It's about learning and growing.
Again, it's not about they don't deserve it, right? Because you're thinking, oh, but I can't. They don't deserve it. You're holding that negative stuff in you when you do that kind of thing. Isn't that right?
Well, it's not only right, but it's when people refuse to forgive, it's a way that they get to be better than someone else, that they get to dominate them and avoid being dominated. And so the question that you have to ask yourself is, am I willing to get off of it? Am I willing to give up dominating this person and being right about something? And am I more interested in being happy and at peace, or am I more interested in being right and dominating? And the answer will give you, you know, the direction that you're going
to
go.
We circle all the way back around to choice. And I got a couple more questions. I want to ask it. There's some other things I want to continue to ask. Let's talk about self-talk and negative self-talk specifically. You know, what are ways that that we can elevate our self-esteem? How do we get rid of this self-talk? Can you talk a little bit more about how this is accomplished?
Well, the negative self-talk is the at the core of low self-esteem. It's about the little person on our shoulder that echoes, you know, an authority figure, or even ourselves beating ourselves up because we're not worthy. And so the essence of eliminating the self-talk is not really eliminating it, but recognizing it. Recognizing when that person is saying something to you that has you be less than, unworthy, or beat yourself up in some way. And then, you know, thank the person, because, you know, we call that little person Chip. And it's kind of like a chip on your shoulder, that it's a little gremlin that constantly is keeping you stuck and small and preventing you from risking and thinking that you're going to be safe that way. But what that self-talk really does is it keeps you stuck. It keeps you from evolving and being happy and progressing in your life and manifesting the things that you want. So the key is to recognize when the self-talk is going on, and to not only recognize it and reinterpret what's going on in the moment, but to actually affirm the opposite of the negative self-talk. So that if someone's telling you, you know, that you, I don't know, that you're ugly and that you're, you know,
and you're broke and you'll always be broke,
right, and all of these things, you know, affirm the things that you do well, and affirm the good qualities that you have, and affirm the things that make you feel good, because life is really about where we're going to focus, and we can focus on the negative or we can focus on the positive, and we can look for the good in people as well as ourselves, or we can look for our shortcomings.
Choice, 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 choice. It's up to you,
yep.
Right?
Totally.
You know, Joe, you have written a plethora of just phenomenal books that are out there. I just love your stuff. Specifically, I understand along these lines, you've written two other books, and one of them titled The Magic Lantern. I love this kind of story-ish type of books. A Magic Lantern, a fable about leadership, personal excellence, and empowerment, if I get this right here. And the other one, titled The Legend of the Lightbearers, which is, it says, a fable about personal reinvention and global transformation. Can you tell us quickly a little bit about these two other books out of your the Joe Rubino Library?
Well, these two books are basically a story format. If you like The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and all of that, they take place in another world, and all of the principles that we've discussed for the last hour are incorporated into the books.
You're the next J.R. Tolkien.
I don't know about that, but I had the most fun writing these books, and they're great for anywhere from teens on up through adults, and each chapter explains a different adventure that the characters in the books have, and they all learn lessons from each of the adventures. And what we do is we actually teach a personal development course called Conversations for Success, and a lot of the principles that I teach in those courses are actually mirrored in the lessons that each chapter of The Magic Lantern and The Legend of the Lightbearers relates. And it's just a lot of fun, and sometimes it's a lot easier to get the distinction, so to speak, when they're in a fun story format.
Oh, gosh.
All
of the best teachers, as you well know, teach in parables and teach in stories. People are just naturally storytellers. I think stories are one of the most wonderful ways that you can actually learn things. So I'm going to grab these. I think that anytime you can read something that's fun at the same time, holy cow! I don't have to be. It's one thing to pick up Think and Grow Rich. It's not necessarily a story. Although actually, and I think about it even then, it's sprinkled with stories throughout the whole book. Mm-hmm. So that sounds great.
All your books are absolutely phenomenal, Joe. And we're running out of time here on the show, so how can people get in touch with you and learn more about the Center for Reinvention and get a hold of these books?
Well, they can visit my website, and we have a free newsletter that they're welcome to subscribe to. My website address is www.centerforpersonalreinvention.com, CenterforPersonalReinvention.com. Anyone that is interested in coaching, I offer personal and group coaching. They can reach me via email at Dr. J. Rubino, DrJRubino, at email.com, email.com, or they can call me at 888-821-3135.
Wow, fantastic. All just tons of information. And ladies and gentlemen, we've had Joe on the show before, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. There is so much more information and so much more powerful things that he has to teach you and to tell you that you can't miss it. Go to
this
website
and
check it out.
This guy walks his talk as well. This is a...
Absolutely.
Joe is very much a guy, as we've known him, that comes at this whole perspective from the right angle, and that is actually everything that's coming through here is really what we've known him to be. This is a guy that truly wants to give and understands that in giving you receive as well. So
absolutely.
Well, you guys are both on the path, and I just enjoy you so much in your work, and so I just always find it an honor to speak with you, and I've really enjoyed this last hour.
Oh, shucks. And ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank you for joining us here at the Net Millionaire Buzz Radio Show. And thanks to Joe for joining us today. And find out more about the self-esteem book, The Ultimate Guide to Boost, the Most Underrated Ingredient for Success and Happiness in Life. And all of his other programs at the Center for Personal Reinvention.com. And should you have any questions or comments about today's show, or would like a copy of today's show, or any other of our shows with the top training experts, go to www.netmillionairebuzz.com. And remember, the Net Millionaire Training System is on sale at netmillionairetraining.com. We'll see you all next week. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Ross and Rob. Appreciate you guys.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Absolutely.